Hello, and welcome to Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Patrick Glavo, and I'm going to be your host this week on Health Matters. We are excited to have you with us. Again, this is your weekly dose of Health Matters. We're going to be talking about all things health. Well, that's not entirely true. Tonight, we are specifically going to be talking about COVID. Shocker. I know, you haven't heard about COVID. It's this new virus that's going around, and we're going to be talking about it a little bit tonight. So I know that, you know, get prepared. It may blow your mind a little bit. But at any point, if you want to join the conversation with us tonight and talk about COVID specifically, we will be talking about rehab and the rehabilitation needs of patients who have recovered from COVID. Please call in 1-800-552-8502. We always love to have people on to talk with us about it. So again, 1-800-552-8502. Let me introduce our guests for the evening. They are all coming to you live via satellite. We have a Zoom meeting going on here with all of our guests. We have Dr. Tim Gilmore, who is the Program Director, Associate Professor of Cardiopulmonary Science Program at the School of Allied Health Professions at LSU Health Shreveport, and is a respiratory therapist. So, Dr. Gilmore, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. We also have with us Dr. Suzanne Tinsley, who is the Assistant Dean of Development for the School of Allied Health Professions. She is the Associate Professor of Physical Therapy and a board-certified specialist in Neurologic Physical Therapy. Dr. Tinsley, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We are glad to have you. And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Jonathan Eaton, who is the Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine and Critical Care Medicine at LSU-HSC and is also just a faculty intensivist. So he has been in the front lines of the COVID crisis since it started. So quite an august group. Welcome, Dr. Eaton.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We are glad to have you. So like I said, tonight we're going to be talking. We've talked a lot about on this show various different times. We've talked about, you know, signs of COVID, symptoms of COVID, what it means for the world, all these kind of things. And tonight we're going to be talking a little bit more specifically. We're going to be talking about maybe the long-term effects of having a COVID infection and what it looks like from a rehabilitation standpoint. So appropriately enough, we have a respiratory therapist, you know, rehab for lungs, physical therapy rehab, and neurologic rehab specifically. So rehab for various other places. And then again, Dr. Eaton, who's just on the front line and sees these people post-infection and post-intubation on a daily basis. So I think we've got a really good crew here, and I guess I wanted to jump in a little bit. Dr. Gilmore, for those who don't know, and Dr. Tinsley, we'll get to you in a second. Dr. Gilmore, can you explain to me exactly what the role of a respiratory therapist is? I know that we've probably seen it. A lot of us have had family members in hospitals, and we've seen people walk around, and they've said, oh, that's the respiratory therapist. But most people probably don't know what that entails. Can you kind of give us a little explanation of that?
Sure, be glad to. So a respiratory therapist is essentially a healthcare provider who is trained in the sciences of medicine at a slightly different level than a physician. We work under the direction of a physician, but we are licensed healthcare providers that take care primarily of patients that have pulmonary disease as well as cardiovascular disease. And so these things often overlap. I guess for the listener, if you have ever heard someone's on the news in critical condition on life support, we are the therapists that work the life support machinery. So behind the scenes, the respiratory therapists, certainly along with, of course, the physicians and the neuro rehab specialists, are on the front lines every day. And, you know, we're really a part of the healthcare team, although you don't see the respiratory therapist on the movies and TV like you do maybe the physicians or the nurse. But we are there taking care of patients when they're in their weakest state in an intensive care unit.
Very cool. Very cool. I appreciate the lay perspective. Sometimes I feel like that helps me more than anything. Dr. Tinsley, I think everyone's pretty well versed in physical therapy because we've all probably gone through it at some point. Legitimately, everyone has broken something and had to be sent to physical therapy. But explain to me, what is physical therapy? What role have you seen physical therapy playing? Just in brief, because we'll get into it more in detail as we go along. Just kind of in brief, what is the role of physical therapy in the treatment of COVID patients and COVID recovering patients?
Well, primarily, I think for any of us that are working with patients that have been hospitalized, particularly with the COVID patient or been extremely sick, is our number one goal is to get that patient back to their most maximum functioning that we can get them back to. So the idea of being able to identify because of their sickness or because of their hospitalization, what are their deficits? What are their problems? And then try to address those. You know, our overall goal is to just get patients back to their quality of life and the maximum amount of functioning that we can get them to post-illness.
Well said. So I guess to really understand the issue, something that I would like to I mean, just go ahead and answer this for me. So what causes people, and this can go out to anyone clearly. So what causes someone to need to be put on a respirator to begin with? So a ventilator, a respirator, a breathing tube. I feel like these are names that are tossed around on either the news or maybe in movies that, you know, these are all sort of referencing the same thing. So this is a assisted breathing device. It's helping you breathe, or it's breathing for you, depending on your status. So can you kind of give me some explanation as to that? Like, why do people have to be put on these?
Dr. Eaton, you're up.
It's a great question. The biggest reason that we put people on ventilators, especially related to COVID, is that we're unable to get enough oxygen into their blood using other means that are less invasive. Being put on a respirator typically means having a breathing tube put down your throat. And there's other ways prior to that to give somebody oxygen from a simple nasal cannula in the nose to a face mask, or even to a more kind of a better, bigger mask that allows us to use a ventilator type machine. But if those things are all not working, then we have to proceed to putting somebody on a ventilator, again, meaning putting a tube down their throat and trying to use the ventilator to give them more oxygen. You know, we're all breathing 21% oxygen right now, which is room air. But oftentimes these people are requiring a much higher concentration of oxygen, up to 100%. Oxygen, which means there's no other gases in the air that those people are breathing. So that's the main thing as it relates to COVID. There's many other reasons why somebody could have to be put on a ventilator, but those are the main ones in relation to COVID.
Now, what's going on that they're not getting enough oxygen to their blood? Because I think that's a kind of a, you know, that's something that I'm sure you think about, you know, that's just second nature to you. You understand this very easily. But what's happening, like, actually physically in someone's lungs that they are not exchanging oxygen as well as they ought to be in regards to COVID specifically? Because clearly there's a couple different things.
So, I mean, again, kind of a great question. And one of the things that we still don't completely 100% understand as it relates to COVID, I mean, you know, it really kind of caught us all off guard. I can very vividly remember back in middle of March, taking care of the first wave of these patients to come through. And we really didn't understand why these patients were the way they were. Everything that we were doing, even on ventilator management, nothing seemed to be working to improve the amount of oxygen getting into somebody's blood. That was a big challenge. I think some of the stuff that has come out since has indicated that there seems to be this, kind of, I'll call it micro blood clotting, really small blood clots that have gone throughout the lungs. And that prevents oxygen from getting into the bloodstream, and thus being able to get oxygen to organs, et cetera. But there's still kind of some unknowns regarding why exactly the lungs are so bad, in particular with COVID, as opposed to other disease processes.
I gotcha. And I think that I almost feel like this is, again, pretty known at this point, but I'll throw out the caveat there that a lot of this information is changing on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis. So, you know, as we're speaking now, we are coming to you. I am here, I suppose. So that is true. We are coming to you from a best knowledge at the moment kind of standpoint. So, you know, these are the current practices that are happening from both a respiratory physical therapy and from an intensive care standpoint. So this is what is currently being done and currently happening. Honestly, it's probably a lot different than the way things looked 3 months ago. And it may be a lot different than the way things look 3 months from now. But this is just sort of almost a snapshot in time. What are we doing in September of 2020 as it deals with the sequelae delay in the treatment of COVID patients. So I guess I want to throw that out there as a caveat, because I know somebody could call in and say, well, I saw an article that came out of Germany that they're doing a new thing. And it's like, well, that may be. They may be doing a new thing, and we may be doing it next week. But this is what we're doing now. And anyways, if you read that article and you want to call in and tell us about it, 1-800-552-8502. We love to hear about obscure German articles. So now, if someone is on a vent and they need to have something breathing for them, and you know, this is, I guess, a question to Tim and Jonathan. Do they have to be in a coma? Are they already to a point? You know, you hear about that medically induced coma, and that's kind of a terrifying statement. Like, do you have to be in a coma to be on a breathing tube?
So I think that's a great question, because I think that's a very common thing the lay person in public hears is somebody's in a medically induced coma. So from an ICU perspective, what does that really mean? That basically means that we have somebody on medications to keep them that's related to having a breathing tube in their throat. Okay. It can be uncomfortable to people. And, you know, our respiratory therapists really do help out a lot with those kind of recognition throughout the day, because they're at the bedside. Some people tolerate it just fine. They don't have to have any medications to help them stay relaxed and calm while the tube's down. And others have to have a lot. Just kind of depends on how every individual person reacts to it.
Have you, Dr. Gilmore, have you seen any difficulties, or maybe have you noticed any difference between patients that are in a medically induced coma versus that are not, when you're treating them and you're actually dealing with the respirators themselves?
Absolutely. If you think about, and the way we talk to our students who are in the cardiopulmonary science program at LSU, is I imagine that you're sticking your head out of a window and trying to breathe going a very high rate of speed down the interstate. Well, it's very difficult, because normally as you have a sensation that you want to take in a breath, it happens naturally when your diaphragm contracts. And there's a lot more to it, of course. But essentially, it would be like someone attempting to do mouth-to-mouth to you while you're awake and alert. And it's not normal. We don't normally have positive pressure in our lung tissue when we breathe. And therefore, to put someone on mechanical ventilation, also known as a respirator, life support, you've heard all the terms, mm-hmm. it basically means that we are forcing air, oxygen, into their lung tissue against the normal way that the body is designed to take on gas. And so sometimes they fight the ventilator. We say they fight the vent, meaning that it's not comfortable for them. And therefore, they have to be sedated or put into a medically induced coma. It's ideal that they're not, because they recover. They seem to recover better if they're not in a medically induced coma. But as Dr. Eden said, it's often necessary. And the patients sure appreciate not remembering the worst part of being on a respirator. And they tell you that later on, that they don't remember a lot necessarily, and that can be a very good thing. But I'm sure, as Dr. Tinsley will weigh in, that can have implications as well, because they lose their track of time, and also they lose some of their muscle mass and things, which is not my expertise. But back to your original question, I really feel like it's easier from the standpoint of the clinician to manage someone who mm-hmm. is not really struggling against the machine, but it's not always the best. And that's where a really good critical care physician comes in and makes that determination.
I gotcha. Okay, very interesting. So what about, so clearly it can't be, you kind of talked, you alluded to this in your statement. You said that people, they lose muscle mass, they lose, because, you know, your breathing is the action of a muscle. So do you find that people have troubles breathing on their own when they have been breathing, when something has been breathing for them, essentially, when they have not been contracting those muscles and they have not had to do the work of breathing themselves? Do you find that trying to get them off a ventilator can be challenging because that muscle that's normally there has kind of gone by the wayside?
Absolutely. If you think about your diaphragm, it literally contracts every 3, 5, 8 seconds, depending on how fast you breathe normally at rest. And when you take that out of the equation, and that muscle that's used to squeezing time after time in a moment, we say 12 to 20 times a minute that an average adult will breathe. Well, every time that they're taking in a breath, the diaphragm is squeezing, contracting. It's a muscle, as you mentioned. And so if you take that muscle out of play, just like if you were to sit down for 2 or 3 days and not move, you would get weak in your legs. Your breathing muscle becomes weak and even atrophied. And so it's a very tedious process, and we actually call it weaning because you have to slowly decrease the amount of help that someone receives on that respirator. Otherwise, we set them up for failure. Once we take them off of that machine, they'll need it again very soon, maybe immediately.
Now, Dr. Tinsley, do you have any kind of role in these patients who have probably lost some degree of respiratory capacity or maybe even physical capacity who've been on the vent for a while? Like, what's the protocol for these patients? What do they have to go through?
Well, I think if we look at specifically COVID-19 and those individuals that have survived that virus, we find that there's a multitude of problems that they have. General, they're just functionally disabled, disability, just generalized weakness from not getting up and moving around, not being active. And so we certainly have to be able to get people back up, get them moving, get them stronger in terms of just their generalized muscle wasting. But then we also see these individuals might have some specific neurological problems. Polyneuropathy or a Guillain-Barré type syndrome is being identified in patients that have survived COVID. Certainly, sleep disturbances. Every patient that I've seen in our faculty practice clinic post-COVID in more of the chronic recovery stage have sleep problems. They don't sleep normally. And I think that's, again, that idea of might being a little bit sedated while they were vented or in the hospital, and then kind of losing track of day and night and missing their circadian rhythms. We see people also just be extremely fatigued. We just the idea of what you and I would do in a 5-minute span, and we're not that tired. Patients that have been so debilitated, they can do something for 2 or 3 minutes and then need to significantly rest because either their heart rate is too elevated or their oxygen saturation has dropped too low.
And that, I think some of these specific things that you talked, so first of all, you've mentioned a couple of very interesting things that I would actually like to dive into. I'm going to probably make a little note there because I'd like to talk about those. But I feel like, Dr. Eaton, you can kind of speak to this maybe. Do you see that people that are on the ventilator for COVID-related lung problems, do they tend to be on the ventilator for longer than a standard patient or less time? I mean, that's kind of a generic, you're comparing a very small subset against the world. But I mean, in your experience, does it seem like they have a better time on the vent or a worse time on the vent or longer or shorter?
No, that's a really good question, actually. From what we've seen, again, kind of the average, I mean, everybody is not always as from what we've seen, these patients that have COVID-19 tend to spend much longer on the ventilator than, say, even a patient with a really bad a flu infection or just a really bad pneumonia. It's nothing for these patients to be on the vent for 1, 2, 3, even 4 weeks or longer. And if, you know, the way I always tell patients and their families, you know, imagine yourself laying in a bed, even for just a single day, single 24-hour period without ever getting up and moving, you're going to feel terrible the next day. You're going to feel incredibly weak. And this just 24 hours, it's just one day. Think about somebody laying in a bed for an entire month straight on the ventilator, sedated, trying to get their lungs to improve. And imagine the profound weakness that they're going to have. And that's really where the difficulty comes in with trying, using our respiratory therapist to try and wean these patients off. And then once we get to that point, then having them have to undergo really significant rehabilitation with people like Suzanne, trying to bring these people back to any functional status, much less back to what they were before this happened.
Dr. Tinsley, that brings up a question. Do you see any, you know, you work with people all the time that have had severe debilitations, whether they were in a car accident and they haven't walked in 2 months or, you know, I feel like that's not abnormal for you to see some people who need really serious rehab. But what have you noticed? You mentioned a couple things. What do you find that they have a specific, like it's more challenging with COVID patients to rehab them, or does it seem like they seem more willing to get better? I mean, have you noticed any generalities that you can make?
Well, I've noticed one, that the level of disability or the level of functional abnormality or problems that we see, you know, I've seen that before, but it's in a patient that maybe had gotten progressively worse over time and had a multitude of of medical complications, but we're seeing patients that are healthy individuals running 3 miles a day, working, you know, a full-time job in their on their farm, et cetera, and then all of a sudden they get this COVID, they're in the hospital, they're on a vent 30, 40, 50 days, and then when I get them, they are just the rapid decline that has occurred. And so it's really quite frightening in that here you've got people that really had no medical issues whatsoever. They caught this virus, they were hospitalized, and now they're coming to me, you know, people that are 40 and 50 coming on a walker and, you know, not being able to get up off of a chair or off of a mat by themselves, are, you know, being able to walk 10 feet or 15 feet and having to sit down. That is, I think, what has been most eye-opening to me is the rapid decline that can occur.
Yeah, and I think that it's probably, I think it is interesting that they have this. I think there's also some degree of almost selection bias in this, because this is probably one of those times where we've seen such a large number of people all in one short span who have been on the vent for so long. I feel like, and you know, Dr. Eaton can speak to this, but I suspect that the number of people who have stayed on a vent or who have been, you know, sedated in the ICU for longer than 3 weeks, the number is probably way above what the average number of those individuals would be on a given, maybe even a given decade, just because, and so all of a sudden you have this huge population of patients to look at and go, this is incredible. Like, this is the effect of being on a vent for so long. And normally we see, you know, one of these every, you know, 6 months kind of thing, who's been on a vent for 3 months before they get off. But now we're seeing this huge population of these people. So you know, that presents a whole new series of problems for you having to come up with resources and manpower and methods to help these people improve. Have you found that that has been something that y'all are getting better at and you feel like you're becoming more accustomed to, and you're kind of filling in that niche need that maybe wasn't there before?
Well, for me, from a rehab standpoint, you know, certainly as Dr. Gilmore talked about, there's that pulmonary issue, and all of them have that problem. But for me, it has really been quite challenging because nobody looks alike. Everybody is different that's come through for rehab, in terms of they might have weakness, but where some person or some individual might be weaker in their proximal muscles, then the next person is weaker in their distal muscles. Or somebody might have their left leg is weak, but their right upper extremity is weak. It doesn't follow a pattern. So it's made me as a clinician be very attuned to make sure that I look at the whole person, the whole patient, to identify, you know, actually what their problems are, so that we can begin to address those one by one.
You got
to
really,
no really pattern with
you,
them.
You have to dip into your training again, and you kind of have to forget all the patterns that you've learned over years of practice and kind of remember, oh yeah, I guess I have to figure this out from scratch. It's like being a student all over again.
It is.
Dr. Eaton, we've touched on a couple things that I think are interesting. She was talking specifically about, you know, you see these people who were running 3 miles a day and they worked on their farm and they, you know, and these are the flashy headlines. This is what we saw back in, you know, because at first in February, everyone said, it's just the flu. Old people and young people are going to get it. You know, we millennials, and I say we because I am in fact a millennial, we millennials are safe. It's not a big deal. And then, you know, everybody loves it, at least in the media, when it's like, oh my gosh, a 35-year-old father of two who runs every day is sick. This is the best. And they, you know, they run for the hills with it. But that being said, I feel like that was flashy at first. But over the months, we've seen that really does happen. It's not the norm necessarily, but it's not as anomalous as it would be with something like, you know, pneumonia or the flu. So what is it that seems to make people more predisposed to having this illness? I mean, there's got to be something to it. It can't just be completely, you know, Russian roulette with viruses.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is something that's been discussed a lot in the media and elsewhere as to, you know, who gets this virus. I mean, certainly, yes, we've seen the 35-year-olds who have no medical problems whatsoever. They've never been in a hospital since they were born, at least. And they are profoundly affected. But certainly that's not the most common that we've seen. Most commonly it seems the obese, the overweight, are particularly affected by this virus. People who have diabetes is one of the other big risk factors. And certainly we've seen, high blood pressure, anybody who has these chronic medical problems, even if they're well controlled with medication, et cetera, those people seem to be at higher risk for getting COVID and getting a more severe course of it. But certainly anybody is at risk. We haven't seen a ton of, children with it. We haven't seen a lot of young adults with it, but certainly anybody can be at risk. We've had our fair share of the 30 year olds who come in with no prior medical problems and have a severe illness, but seems to be those that have chronic medical problems are at much higher risk for that.
Now, and this is asking you to probably know something that is not fully known. Maybe it is, but do you have any inclination? Is there any discussion as to why, for example, young children seem to be disproportionately unaffected? I'm sure there are theories that have been bandied about, but is there any sort of predominant theory right now?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, I would say a couple of months in, a lot of family members or friends, non-medical friends, were asking, well, do I need to worry about my kids getting this? And at the time, there was very few reported cases or even around the world of children getting this. And even looking now, it still is not common for children to have COVID or have a severe respiratory illness from it. Certainly my pediatric colleagues would be better people to answer those kind of questions. But I don't know that we really do know why children are not as affected. Certainly there's fewer children that have chronic medical issues as there are with young adults. And I think that's probably a good part of the reason why. But as far as anything specific, I think that goes back to that we still just don't know a lot about this virus in general.
It's very interesting. I will throw out a personal anecdote, which everyone wants to know. My wife had our first child in the midst of the pandemic. So we had a pandemic baby and no one was allowed to come visit. And it was very odd because nobody knew. It was like, okay, you've got this infant. Traditionally, this is someone who's going to be in a lot of danger. But we really just don't know. I mean, your parents coming may be more dangerous to you and your wife than it is to your newborn. It was a very interesting situation because, pretty much no one could say, yeah, you should have your family over. Like everyone said, no, we really don't know. So the safest thing is just to say, kind of isolate yourself. So, a very interesting from an academic standpoint. All right.
And on that note, too, we actually have a baby on the way in November. And
we're congratulations. Don't just gloss over that.
Any questions?
He's frozen. He's coming back, people. Don't worry.
Well, it's interesting times.
Yeah, man, it's very interesting. Congratulations on your upcoming child, by the way.
Thank you.
Now, I'm playing music here because that means that we're going to have a break in the serious for just a second because too much serious is bad for all of us. The world's serious enough. World's hard enough. So, you all, this is my style of... Wait, don't tell me, that's not my job. So for those of you who are NPR listeners, you know that they have people on who are experts and they will ask them questions that are in absolutely no way related to what they are experts on. And I have chosen something that is very similar. So today we are talking about the pandemic, but I'm going to ask you, do you know about the pandemic, which is the name I've come up with for the explosive love of pandas that seems to have taken over the world in the last decade? So these are all going to be panda-themed trivia questions. Now, I will be nice, and I have created multiple choice, but in each one there is only one correct answer, and I'm going to have to get an answer from everybody. So now, I've written these out, so I'm going to read them for you. We all know that the panda is the mascot of the fast food chain Panda Express. Now, shockingly, there are no pandas being served or serving at the restaurant. This is because they are mostly either in the wild or in a breeding system implemented throughout the world's zoos. Now, which of these zoo-based panda facts is accurate? So I'm going to give you four options. Only one of them is true. One. Pandas are the most expensive animal to maintain in captivity, up to five times as expensive as an elephant, which is considered to be the next most expensive animal. is at number two. Pandas are normally very aggressive animals, and however, in captivity, they become relatively docile and playful, giving the false impression that they are sweet, but in nature, they're actually pretty aggressive. Number three, pandas in captivity are known to bond with members of the community, getting more excited and pacing back and forth in their enclosure when certain people come back to visit the exhibit. Or is it number four, pandas can only be kept in captivity under international law if they are guilty of a crime and are thus being placed in panda jail?
I got to go with four immediately. I already know the answer.
I mean, four seems like the obvious choice. I agree.
I say one, that they're expensive to take care of.
You say number one. All right, Dr. Eaton?
I mean, since it hadn't been, I'll go with number two, since nobody else has picked that one.
All right, they're aggressive animals. It is actually number one, Dr. Tinsley. They are apparently very expensive to keep. I think this is related to their feeding is particularly expensive. All right, we're not done. Don't worry, there are more panda questions. This is why we had you on tonight, for the hard-hitting facts, for the panda trivia. All right, now we know that the panda is endangered, and it has been since the 1990s. Which of these panda procreation facts is contributing to this problem? Number one, pandas are only fertile 3 to 5 days per calendar year, meaning that a given panda can only reproduce a relatively limited number of times in their lifespan. Number two, the average lifespan of the wild panda is about 7 years, though it's about 15 in captivity, and it takes them 5 years to reach sexual maturity. Therefore, a panda in the wild only has about 2 years to reproduce before it pretty much dies. Number three, bamboo, their main food source, is a plant that is high in a naturally occurring phytoestrogen, and this significantly decreases the fertility of the adult male pandas. Pandas in captivity are thus fed a diet that does not involve this bamboo and are typically more fertile. Or is it number four, male pandas are usually considered to be bad listeners, and as a result, panda relationships suffer and there are fewer panda offspring?
I'll go with number four on this one.
You're going to go with number four. Male pandas are bad listeners and therefore have fewer babies. I think that is probably pretty relatable. Dr. Gilmore.
Number two for me.
Going number two. All right. They're only alive for 7 years in the wild and they take 5 years to reach sexual maturity. Dr. Tinsley.
No, I say number one. I don't think they're, I mean, I don't know quite the number of hours or days, but I think that's a problem.
Once again, Dr. Tinsley, with the correct answer, they are fertile for 3 to 5 days per calendar year. An average panda lives about 15 years in the wild, and they are notoriously good listeners. All right, last one, and then we'll go back to serious stuff, and I know that everyone will appreciate that. 1-800-552-8502 if you know any fun facts about pandas. So you may know about pandas, but what about their famous business venture, Panda Express? Number one. Panda Express started as The Chunky Panda, which was a Canadian restaurant owned by famed entrepreneur Brent Chang after his visit to Hong Kong in 1983. Number two, the most successful Panda Express is in the Ala Moana Food Court in Honolulu, Hawaii, which brings in $4 million a year. Number three, the Panda Express Test Kitchen was the initial inventor of orange chicken, a dish that was made with more sugar to appeal to the American palate of sweeter goods. Whereas number four, Panda Express's CEO is Bobo the Panda, who currently resides in his L.A. mansion and eats a diet of only chow mein. No, this is tough. This is tough. Number four, again, seems pretty real. I've seen the pictures on the billboard. There is that panda. Maybe that's Bobo.
Is there a Bobo option for this one?
One of these is correct, I will say, because I Googled this. I made up three of these. Half of the fun of this for me is getting to creatively lie. But the other part is, you know, reading interesting facts about Panda Express. One of these is correct.
Dr. Tinsley, the answer, whatever it is.
All right, Dr. Tinsley, I feel like we're going to go to you first, and then the others can decide if they want to deviate.
I'm torn between two and three. I'll go with two.
Which was the Ala Moana Food Court?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll go with number one.
All right, so that's the Chunky Panda, Canadian restaurant. Dr. Gilmore, are you going to default to Dr. Tinsley's answer?
I was leaning towards two.
All right, so the Ala Moana. That is correct. The most successful Panda Express is in Hawaii, bringing in $4 million a year in the food court. $4 million a year in the food court. Y'all, we messed up. We all could have had a franchise. Come on, like that's what we should. Either way.
And lived in Hawaii.
Now, the cost of living is exponentially higher there, so maybe that's the problem. Maybe $4 million in Hawaii, it's like actually a pretty like sad-looking Panda Express, because, I mean, the panda on Yuri, I love. This is not a plug for Panda Express. I'm sorry. We are not paid to support Panda Express, but if they wanted to give me some chow mein later, I would take it. Anyways, those are my pandemic questions, so thank you for humoring me. A little bit of levity. A little ridiculousness. How do you break back into talking about COVID after that? Let's think. Myocarditis. There we go. That's a good transition. Heart disease. Dr. Eaton, I'm going to hit you up for this one. What in the world is myocarditis, and why is it all of a sudden in the news about all these patients? I combine those two words. These people who have COVID and myocarditis. What's going on here? First of all, what is myocarditis? Can you help me out with that first?
Sure. So myocarditis is actually basically an inflammatory condition of the heart. So I kind of equate it when trying to explain inflammation to patients and their families is, when you get a knock on your arm or your leg, you skin it up or whatever, the redness that forms around that is the inflammation. So imagine that same sort of process in COVID occurring really throughout the whole body, in the lungs and causing the respiratory issues they have, but also potentially even in the heart. It's not a new problem with COVID. It's something that we have seen even with other viruses, with the flu and other viruses like that. But it's kind of one of the more, I guess, scary problems that can happen with COVID. So it's gotten a little bit more of the press, especially related to younger people in general. It received a lot of talk with the Big Ten in college football, and that being one of the reasons they initially kind of canceled their season was this kind of unknown about how common myocarditis may be in younger people that have gotten COVID.
Yeah, and I found an article. I was talking about this. It was from one of two German studies that was published in JAMA Cardiology. So again, here we go, obscure German studies. Those are the best of the studies, I find. They were talking about, they did cardiac magnetic resonance imaging, and they found heart involvement in 78 patients and active cardiac inflammation in 60. This was out of 100. And then they had detectable levels of high sensitivity troponin in 71 of these patients. However, then they go on further in the article to say they, did a cadaveric study, and it looked like most of them were fine and that the hearts didn't appear to be overly infected. And so their kind of conclusion was overt fulminant myocarditis has been reported in isolated patients with COVID-19. However, the current data indicate that the presence of COVID-19 in cardiac tissue does not necessarily cause an inflammatory reaction consistent with clinical myocarditis. So it's kind of this interesting thing. So we're seeing it, but I guess we just don't really know what it means.
Yeah, and I mean, with so much else COVID-related, there's still so much unknown out there, and the knowledge that we're gaining on a daily basis a lot of times is changing so very rapidly. There's so much information coming out. So I think just like everything else, myocarditis, there's still a lot of questions out there. As I said, it was kind of one of the more feared things because it was young people and having heart problems, which young people typically don't have. But agreed that there's still a lot we don't know.
Right. And I think that what about people who have mild cases? I don't know this because these were all looking at like severe COVID patients like this study. This was not looking at people who just tested positive and were wandering around feeling great. Has there been any evidence to suggest that there may also be like myocarditis in patients who have relatively limited cases?
And I think that's really what the issue was with the college football and Big Ten was, what about these kids? I say kids, these 18, 19, 20-year-olds, 25-year-olds that have an asymptomatic, completely asymptomatic or just very mild symptoms. And then what is their risk for having some severe myocarditis or other severe illness post-COVID, post-recovery from COVID, like we've seen with some other types of things after COVID? And the answer is, I think we still really don't know. We certainly have not seen a lot of myocarditis
Sure.
in the patients that we've taken care of, but couldn't really comment on you know, what it's been seen like in the community in mild cases.
With all this new data coming out, sort of myocarditis being the hot button topic, have you started doing any additional testing for patients to see if they're having, because I'm assuming you probably aren't trending troponins on patients that have no other indication that they're having heart disease. And I mentioned troponin because that was one of the things that they looked at in this article in JAMA, was they said they had elevated troponins, which is a standard test that you look at for people who may be having a heart attack. Have you started trending anything like that in the ICU for patients that otherwise wouldn't have it? Or is it still, since we don't know anything, kind of still just kind of a question mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more of the latter. Still kind of, we don't really know anything, don't really know what it means, even if they do have elevated troponin, for example. If clinically they're doing well, then I'm going to treat the patient based on how they're doing clinically and not treat a number that we really don't know what the true meaning may be.
I gotcha. Dr. Tinsley, is that something that y'all have had to take into consideration at all? Because I know that, you know, if you think about someone who's got heart disease, you want to be careful with them as they're rehabilitating, because the reason they wanted to cancel football again would be because you're concerned about stressing the cardiac health of a person who has a fragile heart, so to speak. Do you find that that has been an issue with the rehabilitation standpoint, where you have to be cautious for this, or is it not really been an issue?
No, we've seen that most of the patients that we've treated post-COVID from a rehab standpoint do have elevated resting heart rates. Now, is that due to particularly a myocarditis, or is it due to just deconditioning? You know, for me as a clinician, that's not something that I determine, but I will tell you that they do have higher resting heart rates, which then makes the window for us to try to produce some activity, some physical conditioning, very narrow. If their heart rate is starting out at 110, 115, then it doesn't take much activity to get them up, to get their heart rate up to 130, 140, and that's just way too high for somebody that we're trying to rehab, particularly as that patient, it gets older and older. So is it because of myocarditis? That's not for me to say, but we are seeing many of the patients post-COVID in the rehab setting are having elevated heart rates, which then makes their fatigue factor greater.
Yeah, it sounds like it poses a very unique challenge. How do you, it's the classic, can you say damned if you do? I guess you can on the radio. Damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation. If you don't start working out, then you're not going to begin that road to recovery. But if you work out, or you are exercising or rehabilitating, and it's causing, you know, heart issues, then you can't do it. So you kind of are in the maybe catch 22. That's a more family-friendly saying. Sorry, Mom. I know you're listening.
I'll tell you another thing that we're seeing along with that, and maybe Jonathan or Tim can answer this, is that normally in a rehab setting, you know, we would take someone or look at somebody's oxygen saturation through a little finger probe. And from a rehab standpoint, anybody that has an oxygen saturation under 90, we would tell them to sit down, or they would be physically fatigued. They would be somewhat pale. They would feel bad and they would need to sit. And what we're seeing is that these COVID patients are being able to function in a kind of a hypoxic state. So, you know, normally somebody with their oxygen sat in the 80s, they're going to tell you, I don't feel good, or I feel tired, or I can't catch my breath. And we're seeing patients getting their oxygen sats dropping down to 70 before they're saying, oh, I don't feel bad. And, you know, it's very concerning, because we just don't know what we're doing to the organs when we're making them exercise at such a low oxygen saturation, but they don't feel bad.
Sure. So, crazy conspiracy theory of the day then, this is actually a government plan to prepare us all for a life in hypoxic space.
But maybe, you know, either Jonathan or Tim, respiratory or critical care, can allude to how they, it's amazing to me how they can function with that low oxygen and don't feel bad. Where you and I, if we dropped into the mid 80s, we would feel bad.
Yeah, I got a question for Dr. Eaton in a moment, but are these patients polycythemic? Do they have higher hematocrits? Do they have higher red blood cell counts from being hypoxic over a long, or hypoxemic over a long period of time within the critical care environment? Have you seen a trend to that effect? I mean, I know some patients are getting transfused, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it's interesting. There's an interesting point that Suzanne brings up, and interesting question, Tim, as well. So, you know, I would say most of the patients that we're seeing, you know, their hemoglobin levels and their blood levels are still on the low side, as we would see with most of our ICU patients. That would be kind of an interesting thing to look at long term in their, you know, rehab period and see if their hemoglobins have started to come up and are going a little bit higher to try and adjust for that. On the note that Suzanne brought up, it's actually quite interesting because one of the things that we saw, I would say, after the first couple of months, because we started treating people a little bit differently then, was we saw people who were laying in bed that had a, you know, acute COVID and oxygen saturations in the 70s and 80s, and they were sitting there comfortable. And like Suzanne said, normally somebody who had an oxygen saturation that low, they would be sitting there telling you, I feel terrible, I feel short of breath, I need oxygen, like I can't breathe. And these people are sitting there calm, they're breathing with a normal rate, and they're just sitting there relaxed. And so a lot of them, we've called them, they've gotten kind of the nickname happy hypoxemics. And for the most part, we've just let them go. As I kind of said earlier, our tendency is to treat the patient and not treat a number. No, typically if we were to see somebody's oxygen saturation in the 70s, then we would be wanting to do something about that. But they're also usually not feeling good. And these patients, they're feeling just fine. And it's hard, but you almost just kind of have to turn your back or turn, you know, close your eyes. Themselves look so feel terrible, but they're breathing fine. They don't, and doing more to them actually cause more harm. So Suzanne, it's interesting that you're seeing that post COVID as much as we are seeing it even during it.
We are.
One thing I've seen as a respiratory therapist, when you draw a patient's blood and we analyze that arterial blood sample through our modern day machine that we have available, it can dictate whether there is, we call it a shift of the curve, right? Loading of oxygen versus unloading at the tissues. So when blood is loading oxygen at the lung and unloading at the tissues, that relationship can change on a dime depending on the chemistry of the blood. And so I'm thinking that would be a very interesting study to look at. We call it P50 in the profession, but it gives you a readily available number just in a moment of time if you make that selection. And that's something that we use clinically to manage patients on occasion. And it dictates whether there is that normal relationship between oxygen binding with the red blood cell at the lung and on the opposite end at the tissues, does it unload like it should? So that'd be something interesting as well to consider.
That would be interesting.
No, a great discussion and another mystery to be solved in the coming months, presumably. A very interesting idea. So, the myocarditis is kind of a question mark. What about this like post-COVID neuropathy? Now, I found an article from somebody. Let me see who it was from. New England Journal of Medicine. Yeah, they're at least somewhat trustworthy. I don't know. You know, question mark. I'm getting some question mark faces. And they were talking about Guillain-Barré associated with COVID. So, you know, Guillain-Barré is a fun word to say, but can you kind of give me an example? What is this? What are we seeing? And what does it mean to have like this COVID associated neuropathy?
Jonathan, you want that one or do you want me to take it?
We'll tag team it. It's interesting. Suzanne and I have shared a couple of patients recently that have had this issue. Guillain-Barré or a Guillain-Barré type thing is essentially kind of an ascending, meaning moving from the legs up the body, paralysis or weakness of the muscles. And it's actually been something that we're seeing much more and more commonly in patients that both had serious illness and in patients who had relatively almost asymptomatic illness initially. And something that we're seeing, you know, a month down the road or even 3 months down the road before it presents. So it's quite an interesting thing that we've seen kind of a little bit of a cluster here in the past month or two. And Suzanne can probably speak more into that from what she's seen on the outpatient side, taking care of these people.
Sure. When we think about Guillain-Barré, it's just a demyelination of peripheral nerves. And as Jonathan said, we normally, in the more typical, it starts distal and moves proximal, and patients lose both sensory, the ability to feel, and also the ability to move. What I've seen in patients that have recovered from COVID that we've had through our clinic is that it doesn't follow that kind of stocking glove pattern, start and distal, move proximal, and it's very hit and miss. And it tends to be more, what we've seen is probably more proximal in terms of nerve roots in the lumbar region. But again, they don't follow a pattern. But I will tell you, from the patients that we've worked with some interventions that we do for nerves that have become demyelinated, that they are appearing to recover a little quicker than what we've seen with normal Guillain-Barré. So then it makes you think that maybe it's not a complete demyelination, but more of a partial demyelination, because we've seen some rapid return of muscle function with some specific interventions, particularly functional electrical stimulation, just firing that nerve with as much intensity that they can tolerate of electrical stim to try to stimulate that nerve to be active again. And so it's quite interesting.
This is definitely a chance to get in there and get your name on a syndrome, because Guillain-Barré is a little bit a lot. So you could have the Tinsley Eaton, and I'm just saying there's a chance here. Now, I've got a caller here. This is Shelley from Jefferson, Texas. So Shelley, you are on Health Matters. What can we do for you today?
Hi. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you very much for having some good information on today, and some cardiopulmonary and some clinical people on. And y'all brought up a lot of really interesting things. And really, we don't have a lot of time. There's a lot of things I'd love to talk about, but I'd like to ask kind of a what-if question. I just came across a study, and I was wondering if somebody was going to do this, but look at conscious deep breathing for the COVID recovery, and the medical school out of Tucson, Arizona is currently doing one of those. And it's a really interesting prospect, because it gets into the vagus nerve. And I'm wondering if you guys are looking at the health of the vagus nerve. We'd have to do that through heart rate variability. I'm looking at it that way. But there's been a lot of developments around the vagus nerve, its importance in an anti-inflammatory pathway. And anyway, it's a fascinating prospect, but it's since I'm seeing stuff kind of come together, I'm like, okay, this is going to be interesting, and this is going to be interesting how this unfolds. But I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what if the vagus nerve has a lot to do with whether people are getting really sick from this or not? Because the vagus nerve is, now we understand, the vagus nerve has a lot of impact on the autonomic nervous system. And when the autonomic nervous system is off, our immune system is off. And sometimes when we see that sympathetic dominance, we see a lot of inflammatory problems. However, you know, and sometimes it has to do with the vagus nerve not working properly.
So an interesting question. So, you know, have you had any exposure to the conscious deep breathing therapy, or any idea of the inflammatory modulating kind of therapies?
Well, I can say this, of course, appreciate your question, Shelley. The vagus nerve, as you mentioned, one of the most extensively reaching nerves of the body. And as far as breathing goes, there is a lot, back to what Jonathan Eaton said. You've got a lot of inflammation, residual inflammation, and the body has all of these normal reflexes that almost prevent, even voluntary with maximal effort, a deep breath. And patients often go into spasmodic coughing. Think about a normal upper respiratory tract infection. You have what we consider, as a clinician, post-infectious etiology, and it really almost tops the list of why a patient would come into a clinic visit, because it bothers them. They can't stop coughing, and it bothers everybody around them. So You know, the question is very, very good, but I don't think that we're there yet. And I can tell you from personal experience as a respiratory therapist, most of our patients that have any residual irritation or inflammation, even if they want to, even if we instruct them, even if they're going through Dr. Tinsley's intensive rehab process, they're just not going to be able to produce a deep breath with any quality if they have that urge to cough. It's almost counterintuitive. And then you have a pattern of spasmodic coughing thereafter where they essentially lose their breath, if you will, for temporary time period.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a lot of that has to do with education and educating people. And to be honest with you, I mean, I come from cardiopulmonary, and we're taught a lot about disease processes, but we're not taught so much about healthy breathing. And there's a tremendous power in that. And come to find out, our oldest healing tool that we have is conscious breathing. And the science is just now catching up to the wisdom of that, and it's mind-blowing what's going on with that. But because I've been thinking about this in different ways, actually preventing hospital-acquired pneumonias, our best tool that we have is conscious deep breathing. And one of the biggest reasons for that is because it corrects the problem of shunting. You talked about earlier, you know, the having some clots and some things like that in the cardiovascular system and in the perfusion. But if you have a problem in the perfusion, you're going to have a problem ventilating. So, deep breathing actually affects factor 7 or 8 in our clotting factor and our clotting cascade. But it's incredibly, in many ways, it's incredibly complex. But it's a very simple tool that we're born with. But I was very excited to see that the University of Arizona is actually doing a study on that, and I think it's worth looking into a lot more.
No, that's really cool. Well, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate that, and I think that, you know, it also highlights that there's a lot of really cool therapies out there, and there's a lot of cool treatments that are on the horizon. And you know, time will tell what is effective and what is good. But I kudos to anybody who's trying something out. I think that's really great. We're making some progress. Now we are running short on time up here. We are down to what, 3 minutes, 2.5 minutes, because they make me shut down early. So I just kind of wanted to say, first of all, thank you to everybody for being out here. I really appreciate it. I know that it's kind of weird being via Zoom, but y'all were great. I appreciate the input and the expertise and wisdom that each of you has brought from different areas. Is there anything you kind of want to close out with? Anything you'd like to say?
I think I would just say, you know, everybody keep, you know, doing everything you can to try and avoid getting it. We don't know who's going to get seriously affected and who's not. And, everybody keeps doing what they're doing, then hopefully we can see this stuff kind of gradually disappear and for the better of everybody.
No, I appreciate
it. I would say certainly ditto Jonathan's comments, but also for anybody out there that has had COVID, whether it was a asymptomatic case or not very severe case versus someone that's been hospitalized, if you've got some issues post recovery from the disease itself, whether it be fatigue, headache, insomnia, weakness, muscle pain, you know, don't just you think it's going to get better. Seek out some intervention. I mean, there are some things that we can do from a respiratory therapist standpoint, from the medical side, from the neuro rehab side. You know, don't be afraid to say, you know, I'm not back to where I was before.
Agreed. And there's never a harm in finding someone who can help. And I think a lot of people have struggle finding someone who can help. And then Dr. Gilmore, I know we talked about the value of respiratory therapists and all of this, or the cardiopulmonary sciences in general, as our caller was talking about. You were saying that there's an opportunity to become that if you wanted to join this crew. Is that what you were saying?
Absolutely. And they're in very high demand right now. We have a cardiopulmonary science program there at LSU Health in Shreveport. And we take in applications till February each year, and there are many job opportunities currently. And you can get to the front lines and help fight this pandemic, and you can be a part of the solution. So it's an exciting time in healthcare all the way around.
It is. Well, everyone, again, I'd just like to say thank you so much for being on with us. I feel like we had a great conversation. I'm sorry that Dr. Tinsley was unable to be fooled on my quiz, because my greatest joy is going home when no one gets any right. So I'm pretty significantly disappointed about that.
What do I win?
My respect, maybe my ire. I don't know. I don't know if I'm happy about it. Either way, I'm going to go ahead and sign off. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Views expressed on Health Matters do not necessarily express those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Assistance has been provided this evening by Kermit Poling and Wally Derleth. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters.